Election day in Texas. How the balloting appears to be playing out across Texas. We'll check in with reporters across the Lone Star State. That's coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. While state workers clear out homeless encampments in the Texas capital city, a closer look at an underlying problem with affordable housing, skyrocketing land prices. As wildfires threaten housing developments in California, in central Texas, the possibility of wildfires threatening developers' plans. And the Santa Fe High School mass shooting suspect, three doctors find him incompetent to stand trial. What happens next? All those stories and more today on the Texas Standard. No matter where you are, if you're in Texas, it's election day and it's Texas Standard time too. Thanks for spending a bit of it with us on this fifth day of November. All right, take a quick look at that watch or clock on the wall. If it's not yet 7 p.m. where you are and you haven't cast a ballot, well, what are you waiting for? Something important like whether state parks should be supported by sales tax money from sporting goods, or a measure that could clear the way for the creation of a flood infrastructure fund? The future of a state income tax, how about that? There are some special elections seen as a possible signal about the state's political direction in 2020. One of the biggest races to be decided today, who will run the city projected soon to eclipse Chicago as the third most populous in the U.S.? So yeah, there's a whole lot on the table, but what about interest? Well, 10 constitutional amendments to be decided by someone today, and that someone will be whichever Texans care enough to cast a ballot, I suppose. Historically, that's not many, so your vote could carry considerably more weight than you might imagine. Let's check in now with some of the reporters statewide covering today's proceedings, and begin in our hometown, the capital city of Texas, where Jimmy Moss covers politics, among other subjects, for KUT in Austin. Jimmy, good to see you, sir.
Good to see you.
So let's do talk about turnout first. What are you hearing about early voting?
So far, pretty low, and that might be expected. There are no huge races to really get voters too excited about. But there are a couple of propositions that City of Austin voters are deciding today, one of which has the interesting fact tied to it that it has no political support at this point.
You're kidding. No political support. Not even from the sponsor?
Right. So the Political Action Committee that got this is a petition-led proposition that was designed to stop a Major League Soccer stadium from being built. It, in fact, is too late for that. Their ground is being broken. That ship has sailed.
It's going to be built.
Yep. But what that proposition does is have a bunch of clauses that will tax nonprofits that sit on city land that are leasing, like youth organizations, baseball, soccer groups. There's the symphony, things.
So
theater.
This would be in what, perpetuity if it's approved?
That would be city law. They would have to pay, all those groups would have to pay property tax, and that would be effectively where. And they would also have to, if we renew a lease, we'd have to go to a vote for that. So
wow,
yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. Okay, let's go to another issue that I know you have been covering. This has to do with hotel revenue taxes?
Yes, the city council decided to expand the convention center. There was a group that decided maybe that we might need another look at that. So they have petitioned and put this on to ballot. So if Proposition B passes, it will scuttle the move to expand the convention center. And this is where probably it gets a little murky. It will change the way the city divvies up the hotel occupancy tax. And there's some question if it does pass, whether legally we could, as a city, still support the convention center and support all the other things that we try to do with the hotel occupancy tax, just because it may be unconstitutional.
Well, both of these issues seem rather serious, and with turnout as low as at least it has been so far, a lot at stake, with a few voters could make all the difference.
A few thousand people could decide things for a lot of years to come.
Speaking there with KUT's Jimmy Moss. Hey, up in North Texas, Jamie Hancock is assistant politics editor at the Dallas Morning News, and she's going to tell us what's what up there. Jamie, welcome back to The Standard.
Thank you, David, for having me.
All right. So is my understanding that y'all have a special election there because of a change in who is mayor of Dallas? Eric Johnson used to be a representative, right?
Yes, he did. He represented District 100 and its parts of East Dallas, South Dallas, and West Dallas. So we're having a special election to fill his seat. And there are four candidates in that race, James Armstrong, Lorraine Birabil, Daniel Clayton, and Sandra Crenshaw. And all four of the candidates are Democrats.
Did there seem to be any distinctions or any particular major issues that are standing out in that race?
All of the candidates have fairly similar platforms. They all agree that the district needs solutions for better education, health care, reducing crime and police violence.
Mm-hmm. Let's pull back for just a moment. What is your sense of how folks in that district are, how much people are paying attention to this race? I mean, this goes to the question of turnout, I suppose.
Yes.
But what are you hearing?
Well, not very much, unfortunately, because it is just a special election. They only get to fill the seat until January, when that's the remainder of Johnson's term. So in January, they'll turn right really, and after whoever wins this race will turn right back around and have to campaign for the March 3rd primary to fill the seat for 2 years.
Oh, boy.
So yeah, all of the candidates say that they intend on running in that primary.
You anticipated my next question. overall, I mean, there are these constitutional amendments that are on the ballot. Are people talking about this as an election day? I noticed that I wasn't hearing a whole lot about it here in Austin.
You know, you don't really hear a lot of people talking about it in Dallas either. I think the turnout is expected to be pretty low for a constitutional amendment election. But having the District 100 race on there, maybe a few people in that district will turn out just specifically to vote for these candidates. It's only if these candidates made a name for themselves with reliable voters who are going to turn out regardless of anything that's going on because they simply vote in every election.
Jamie Hancock with the Dallas Morning News. Jamie, thanks.
Thank you, David.
Let's go down I-35 to San Antonio, where we're joined now by Texas Public Radio reporter Brian Kirkpatrick. Brian, what are you hearing from voters in Bexar County?
The turnout so far has been very light. Nearly 43,000 ballots cast early out of 1.1 million registered voters. County elections officials believe only 6 or 7% of registered voters will vote today. And the biggest issue seems to be Proposition 4.
Proposition 4, that's the proposition on the ballot that would amend the Constitution to prevent a state income tax, something like that?
That's correct. The voters we have talked to, especially Native Texans, are opposed to a state income tax. They just don't believe we need one because we've never had one before and seem to be doing just fine.
Yeah, even though some people have said it's redundant because of existing state law, but I totally understand why this is on the ballot. Curious, a lot of people have said that the focus on 2020 might be overshadowing the fact that there's even an election in Texas today. What are you hearing about that down in Bexar County?
I believe that's very correct. The county's even gone so far as buying new voting equipment out of concerns, you know, all the past talk of voter fraud or you know, elections being tampered with. These new voting machines come with a paper ballot. After you vote, the ballots are printed out, and then you put it into a scanner. That seemed to work very well during early voting. The elections officials say only one person walked off with their ballot without having it been scanned.
Huh. Very interesting. So we're talking about this election cycle as perhaps a test run of the technology for 2020 there. But I'm also curious about what especially young people are saying, because something that we've been getting a lot of feedback on here is that young people are perhaps more interested in politics. Some young people are more interested in politics than they have been before. Are you getting that sense or hearing from maybe folks at colleges and universities about that issue?
Yes, we are on National Voter Registration Day. We went out to the University of Texas at San Antonio and visited with some organizers there, and they said that there was high interest, very high interest, in the 2020 presidential race on both sides of the ticket.
That was Texas Public Radio's reporter Brian Kirkpatrick speaking with us from San Antonio. All right, it's eastward ho along I-10 and on to Space City, site of one of the biggest races in the Lone Star State today. Joining us now, Houston Public Media reporter Florian Martin. Florian, where have you been this morning?
Hey, David. I'm here at the University of Houston campus where they have a poll for people to go vote on. It's actually the first time they were able to vote here early. Mm-hmm. And, you know, early voting numbers, not that great in Houston. I mean, I guess kind of same story as we've heard from the other cities. It's down 20% from 2015, which was the last mayoral election. Of course, back then, we have to keep in mind, we had the very controversial Houston Equal Rights Ordinance on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, you know, a race for a new mayor because the old mayor, Anise Parker, was term limited. So, you know, fast forward to 2019, and we have an incumbent mayor, Sylvester Turner, who is challenged by 11 candidates for
huge
mayor.
Huge field.
Also, yeah, it's a very crowded race. Even more crowded for council members, more than 100 candidates on there. Yeah, it's been a very negative campaign. Lots of mudslinging between the candidates, accusations of cronyism and corruption, both of Mayor Turner and also some other candidates.
With so many candidates, yeah. Forgive me for interrupting, but with so many candidates, is it likely that there will be a clear victor at the end of this evening, or are we likely looking at a runoff? What are the political wags saying about that?
Yeah, it's pretty likely that there will be a runoff. When we look at the latest poll from the University of Houston, incumbent Mayor Turner got 43% about of the vote, and,
mm-hmm.
and his next challenger, Tony Busby, got about 23, and then that's the only double digit ones. But you know, 43 is far from 50. So yeah, it is expected that there will probably be a runoff, and this negative campaign will, you know, last another 6 weeks.
Florian Martin is a reporter with Houston Public Media covering that race and, of course, all the constitutional amendments that are on the ballot across the Lone Star State. No matter where you are, keep it here as Tuesday progresses for the latest on Election Day 2019 in Texas. All right, be honest, social media editor Wells Dunbar. You cast your ballot yet?
I have not, and I was just saying, man, we have these new machines here in Travis County mm-hmm. to use as well, so I'm going to have to do that after the show.
Amen.
Well, as we've been exploring, it's Election Day, and we've been reaching out to our friends and listeners on social media to see what their thoughts are, and we're hearing primarily about that suite of state constitutional amendments up on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel Anthony, via Facebook, says people are not doing their research on Prop 4 that would enshrine a ban on sales tax in the Constitution. Prop 4 could undermine business taxes, and if Texas gets in trouble financially, we will have shot ourselves in the foot with no way to enact.
Now, did you say sales tax? Are we talking about income tax?
Income tax.
Right.
Yeah, my bad there. Yeah, income tax, rather. Meanwhile, John Seal says this both about Prop 10 and the constitutional amendment election generally. He says, why do we need a constitutional amendment for who can keep a retired dog? Can we get a new constitution that is not so silly? Prop 10 being that one that would allow, police and canine handlers to take those retired service dogs home. He said, John goes on to say, it seems absurd that we have to amend the Constitution to handle something so basic.
We have a pretty big Constitution here
in
Texas.
Isn't the largest state
Constitution? That's what I've heard. Yeah. It might get bigger as a result of tonight. We would love to hear from you, Texas. What's on your news radar? Anything interesting in elections near you? Reach out to us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, back with more of your comments in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Hey, it's a Texas Standard. State officials are clearing out tents, clothes, and other items from homeless encampments under highway overpasses in the Texas capital city. And at the same time, Austin officials are doing the same outside the Austin Resource Center for the Homeless, known as ARCH. If you're not clear on why and what happens next, what this is all about, KUT's Andrew Weber reports, well, you're not alone.
A crew of a little more than a dozen city workers began disassembling camps and tossing mattresses, some tents, and other belongings into a dumpster across the street from the Salvation Army's downtown shelter. Greg McCormick is the executive director of Front Steps, the nonprofit that runs the ARCH. He says the timing for all of this could have been better.
Yeah, the timing is not ideal for sure. Things just kind of fell in line to where this was happening. APD was ready to go with this, and the state evidently is starting their cleanups under the underpasses.
The removal is required by new city ordinances that, among other things, ban camping near the city-owned shelter. Crystal Harris has been camping in the area. The 24-year-old says she only cares about her blanket and a teddy bear. It used to belong to her mom, who died 2 years ago.
My mom only been gone 2 years, and that's still one touchy spot to me. I would act a plumb fool if they was to come over here and bother my stuff right now. But y'all not... It's confusing, it's tiring,
Harris and others said the workers ended up tossing some personal belongings, not just trash, surrounding the camps, and complained the city didn't provide caseworkers to help people displaced by the city's new rules. Protesters shouted down police escorting workers as they made the rounds and tossed pallets and tents into a trash compactor. Later in the day, crews working with the Texas Department of Transportation began clearing up camps under overpasses in South Austin. Those cleanups were ordered by Governor Greg Abbott. He's argued the Austin City Council's policies to address homelessness have made things worse in the city. TxDOT says those cleanups will be weekly, but the schedule for them isn't clear. A TxDOT spokesperson told KUT the situation is, quote, fluid. The state is pushing people displaced from those camps to the Arch, which had about 170 people on its wait list as of Monday morning. McCormick told the state that the Arch is full, but didn't get much of a reaction.
You know, we're full right now, and so I let them know that. They're aware of it, but I'm sure that some people may still come here.
Crystal Harris said she, like others outside the Arch, weren't sure what would come next.
Where is there to go? They're not, that's all that, they, all this is really to try to intimidate somebody. There's nowhere to go.
In Austin, I'm Andrew Weber.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Talk about clearing away homeless camps in the Texas capital city almost naturally forces the conscience to ask the question, what are the alternatives? Shelters are supposed to be short-term, right? But long-term housing? Well, in Texas's fast-growing cities, where will you find the affordable land to build such long-term housing in the first place? A new Harvard University study on the state of the nation's housing underscores the obvious. Rapidly escalating land prices make construction of low-cost housing more than just challenging. Phyllis Snodgrass knows this firsthand. She's CEO of Austin Habitat for Humanity, a nonprofit that builds affordable housing. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here.
Give us an idea of how expensive land has become for you. I mean, for the purposes of building affordable housing, I gather Habitat purchased land in Austin back in the 90s?
We sure did. We have a plot of land that we purchased in near East Austin, very close to downtown, back in the 90s. It was across the street from our old ReStore. And we purchased it for a lumber yard to support the ReStore. We purchased it for less than $100,000. Today, that could hold a traditional, perhaps two homes on it. It's worth $1.4 million, $1.6 million today. So things that we used to be able to afford to purchase and place affordable homeownership on just don't really exist anymore.
I was looking at a map that the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard has put together, and it seems like Central Texas in particular has seen a rapid escalation in land prices. What do you do? Could you move out further, perhaps, and try to build homes in more rural areas?
Well, we do some of that. We actually serve a 5-county area, and there are homes that we have built in the periphery around the Austin area. But we really don't want to push families working and living in Austin to those areas. That is really intended to serve the people that are already living and working in those areas. We don't want to take cost-burdened families who are trying to live and work somewhere close together and put them at really long distances and away from all the services that they might need. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to build housing closer to the core of Austin to serve people that need to work here.
So what is your strategy? If you have housing, if you have land prices rapidly escalating, which obviously drives up the price of the underlying housing, mm-hmm. but you want to keep people close to the urban center, what do you do?
Well, we beg for land. That's one thing we do. We're always out there asking. But honestly, one of the big changes that we've embraced is building up. We're building a denser housing product. We just broke ground on our first row homes in the beautiful Mueller subdivision in Austin, a 5-story condo unit that we've got on the drawing board, and we're hoping to break ground on next year, very close to downtown, right where that lumber yard was. Because for $1.6 million, we can either sell it and move people really far away from the city core, mm-hmm. or we can build housing, 45 units, close to downtown on a piece of land that we own, and it's on transit. So, That's what we're doing.
Yeah, you mentioned the Mueller development, and that's obviously a very upscale urban environment.
Right.
You have that land because it sounds like the city and the developer agreed to set aside land for affordable housing.
That's right. It is almost nearly impossible for us to compete on the market. What has happened in Austin in the last year that we think will play into our future ability to build here is we worked really hard at advocating for a new policy that the city of Austin has. It's called Affordability Unlocked. And for non-housing geeks, basically it lets you build more affordable housing on a piece of land than you could not affordable housing.
What is the long-term strategy and option here? I mean, if the prices are going nowhere but up, does that necessarily squeeze out the continued construction of affordable housing at some point?
We are entering advocacy in a big way and advocating for better policies that allow more housing to be built, also spending time educating the public on affordable housing and trying to design some really beautiful product that the public may be a little bit surprised by, but will be excited to see in their own neighborhoods. The idea is education, letting people understand that everyone deserves a place to live. And we sell homes to hardworking families in this community who can't afford affordable homeownership otherwise. And so it's a game changer for those families. I think everyone agrees that we'd like to have all families have that opportunity. And so we feel like, you know, just we've got to be creative. We basically have to have an all of the above strategy. You know, we actively solicit partnerships with developers and builders. We're out there pitching it constantly because the way we're going to get into neighborhoods is have beautiful product that people are not afraid of and demonstrate our ability to deliver on product.
Phyllis Snodgrass is CEO of Austin Habitat for Humanity. Phyllis, nice to talk with you. Thank you for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Texas Tribune University of Texas poll out today finds 51% of voters in the state want stricter gun control laws. Another 28% prefer them to stay the same, and 13% think the laws should be less strict. The poll's co-director, Jim Henson, says that breakdown has remained relatively unchanged since 2017. He explains that highlights two issues. On the one hand, mass shootings in Texas do not seem to affect public opinion.
On the other hand, and there is more tolerance or even embrace for increased enforcement of existing laws among Republicans, despite what more activist groups say.
Today marks 2 years since a gunman killed 26 people at First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, and 10 years since a mass shooting at Fort Hood left 13 people dead. It's election day in Texas. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has details.
Polls are already open across the state and will close at 7 p.m. Those already in line at their polling location past 7 o'clock can still vote as long as they were in line by 7. Voters throughout Texas get a chance to cast a ballot for 10 constitutional amendments, and voters in Dallas and Houston will decide special elections for 3 Texas House seats. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
The outcome of one of those 3 special elections today could show how much momentum Democrats have heading into next year. The party is expected to maintain control of 2 House districts in Dallas and Houston and has made a strong push to flip a Fort Bend County district that was held by Republican State Representative John Zerwas for 12 years. Rice University political science professor Mark Jones says the race will be seen as a barometer for Democrats' ability to flip the Texas House in 2020.
HD 28 is not in the lowest hanging fruit category of purple seats. It is in the next rung of pink seats that Democrats will have to flip at least a few of if they have any hope of actually taking control of the Texas House.
Jones says the race for House District 28 will likely head to a runoff election between Democrat Liz Markowitz and one of the 6 Republicans running. A bipartisan group of Texas lawmakers is calling on Governor Greg Abbott to grant a reprieve for death row inmate Rodney Reed, whose execution is set for November 20th. The House Criminal Justice Reform Caucus wrote Abbott and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles today, arguing new witness statements and evidence raise serious questions about the case. Reed has maintained his innocence in the 1996 murder of Stacy Stites. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. 8.5%. That was the arbitrary cap that the Texas Education Agency, the TEA, imposed on special education enrollment back in 2004. No more than 8.5% of students. That effectively excluded thousands of students in Texas from accessing services in public schools. The state scrapped that requirement following a 2016 Houston Chronicle investigation into the policy. But according to a new study from the University of California, Davis and Cornell University, the effects of that enrollment cap are far-reaching. Joining us now is Brianna Ballas. She is an economics PhD candidate at the University of California, Davis, and she is co-author of this study. Brianna, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
So just to recap, can you tell us about this old TEA policy of putting a cap on special ed enrollment, why that was so significant?
So at the time that the policy was introduced, around 13% of students were participating in special education programs across the state. And in 2004, the state imposed a cap of 8.5% at the district level. So this mandated that all school districts should serve no more than 8.5% of their students in special education programs. So this placed a large downward pressure on school districts to reduce enrollment, especially for those school districts that were serving significantly more than 8.5% of their students in special education programs. So the policy did two things. It kicked off students from participating in special education and also led to large reductions in the number of students who were eventually diagnosed across the state.
Now, when we talk about diagnosed, what sort of disabilities included in that description?
So the policy really impacted students who had mild learning and behavioral impairments. ADHD, disabilities of that nature were the most impacted by the policy.
And what you wanted to find out, as well as your colleague at Cornell, you wanted to understand how this would affect these students long term, having been denied the benefits of special ed, right?
Exactly.
And what did you find?
So we found that for students who are on the margin of placement decisions, when they're removed from special education programs, they're significantly less likely to graduate from high school and significantly less likely to enroll in college. There were important differences by types of students. So students from lower income backgrounds and minority students were most hard hit by the policy and driving these large negative effects on educational attainment. So to put those into perspective, we find that the policy led to a 54 percentage point decrease in the likelihood of graduating from high school and a 34 percentage point decrease in the likelihood of enrolling in college for these students on the margin.
I want to make sure I understand something. So for those people who are sort of on that line between being admitted or not being admitted, they did not get in to a special education program. Those students were 54% less likely to graduate from high school. Is that right?
That's right. So that's a very large effect for students who are more on the margins of placement decisions. So these are students who have less severe disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so why might we be finding these effects? So one possibility is that the requirements for graduation change when students are removed from special education programs. So one factor that might play a role is the high school exit exam during this time period. But I don't think that this mechanical effect is completely explaining these large effects because we find important differences by different types of students. So while all students in Texas were losing special education, mm-hmm. it was only the students who were from lower income backgrounds who are experiencing these large declines, to suggest that losing special education, if your parents or your schools were able to mitigate or compensate and provide additional services in place of special education programs, your long-run outcomes were less harmed.
As many of our listeners may know by now, TEA did away with the cap after that Houston Chronicle investigative report, and the Texas legislature blocked the TEA from imposing these limits in the future. That doesn't necessarily close the gap in achievement. What has to be done at this point? And I think, is the TEA doing enough from what you have heard?
So from what I've heard, they've lifted the cap and are trying to change what types of students are getting diagnosed. And I think the TEA could do more to kind of train school personnel and things like that. In addition, since we find such large effects on college enrollment and attainment, I think it's going to be important kind of to follow up with students who were impacted by this policy and try to assist them.
Brianna Ballas is a PhD candidate at the University of California at Davis. Brianna, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Hi, I'm Kate Horan. I'm the Library Director for McAllen Public Library in McAllen, Texas. I did not find out that we were the largest one-story library in North America until after we had moved in and the buzz kind of started. And once the word got out, especially also that we were the a repurposed Walmart building, I mean, that appealed to people who prefer not to shop at a big box store, and it also appealed to people who love libraries. They just were really delighted by that transformation. When you're a 123,000 square foot facility that is 2.5 football fields long, you need large signage, right? You can't have a teensy weensy little sign that's just like nonfiction, right? So we have something called mega pendants. And when we were redoing the interior of the building, these mega pendants are basically like an aluminum frame. But when it was just a frame on the floor, I stepped into it and I said, this is an odd place for an office. You know, why is it right smack in the middle of the library? And one of the workers said, oh no, that's the mega pendant. So that gives you an idea of how large our signage is. That mega pendant is about the size of my office. When little children come into the library, they're just overjoyed. And so I just never get tired of seeing the joy and delight on the faces of our visitors. And we have about 50,000 to 60,000 visitors each month. My name is Kate Horan, Library Director of McAllen Public Library, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. As we learn more about the destruction from wildfires in California over the past week, many folks in Texas asking the question, could it happen here? A recent report of cities facing the greatest wildfire risk listed Austin at number 5. The only cities at greater risk? Yep, all in California. As the Texas Standard's Jill Ament reports, with more development popping up in Austin's once wild spaces, there are concerns not enough has been done to prepare for the next wildfire disaster here.
I met Austin resident Randy Jameson at a busy cafe in a strip mall near his neighborhood in Northwest Austin. He lives in River Place, what developers call a master planned community. The neighborhood is home to about 4,000 people and was recently annexed by the city of Austin. Located near Lake Travis, homes here are sought for their hill country and lakeside views. But Jameson's not meeting with me to tell me how much he likes living in this area. He's meeting with me to tell me how nervous he is about living out here.
My anxiety goes pretty sky high when it's hot and dry. We're in a tinderbox.
River Place and several communities nearby face some of the highest risk of catastrophic wildfires in the Austin area. And an audit released in late October by the city of Austin indicated the city isn't doing enough to prepare for wildfires.
Drivers and passengers looked worried as they surveyed the clouds of smoke ahead, stretching for miles.
In 2011, Texas was in the middle of a historic drought. That Labor Day weekend, conditions were ripe for wildfires, very dry and very windy. 9 major wildfires broke out in several places surrounding Austin. The most significant was the Bastrop Complex fire near Bastrop, Texas. That fire destroyed 32,000 acres, 1,600 homes, and killed 2 people. Closer to Randy Jameson's River Place neighborhood, a wildfire in Steiner Ranch destroyed more than 20 homes.
We stood on the crest on River Place Boulevard, looking across at Steiner Ranch and wondering if the fire was going to continue coming towards River Place.
No one was killed in the Steiner Ranch fire, but there's only one way into the community and one way out. That led to some serious evacuation problems. Jameson says it wasn't until those wildfires broke out that he started to realize the risks in River Place.
There's a school, there's the Austin Christian Fellowship Church.
Jameson points out how close homes and businesses are to each other as we drive around his neighborhood. He says he no longer looks at the plants and trees, steep hills and cliffs that are common in this area as aesthetics, but instead components that could easily fuel wildfires. And like Steiner Ranch, Jameson's community is also hard to get in and out of. The main entrance and exit pours out onto a notoriously windy and congested road in that area.
Yeah, it's a congestion. It's already a congestion, but it's a congestion with density waiting for a disaster. It's creating one.
The wildfire outbreak nearly a decade ago served as a wake-up call for the city of Austin. A year later, the city established a wildfire division within its fire department. This division's goal? Reduce the risk of wildfire destruction in Austin. To do this, they mapped out Austin's wildland-urban interface. Think of floodplain map, but for wildfires. This map is commonly referred to as a WUI.
The basic definition is just where human infrastructure meets, you know, wildland habitat.
That's Carrie Hines. She's a WUI expert at the Texas A&M Forest Service.
So anywhere that you could have a wildfire burning that comes into contact with human structures.
The WUI pinpoints which part of a city is at the most risk for catastrophic wildfire damage. Austin's Public Safety Commission says 61% of Austin's homes, businesses, and roads are close to areas that could pose a wildfire risk. After the wildfire outbreak around Austin, city leaders began discussing adopting citywide WUI codes. These are like fire codes, but for wildfires.
The codes look at how dense an area can be built out to, where people can build structures, what building materials can be used, how you manage your vegetation, both natural vegetation and what you plant around your house. Access for emergency vehicles is another really big one.
Hines says adopting these wildfire codes are one of the more effective ways cities sprawling out into their wild spaces can develop safely. The city of Austin has yet to adopt wildfire codes, and in that city audit released late last month, putting these codes in place was listed as the number one priority. Austin City Council member Allison Alter says that's a sign the city could still be doing more to address its wildfire risk.
You know, Austin's an interesting case. On one hand, we are leaders in wildfire and that we created a wildfire division and we have some resources that are devoted to it. But there's a serious question about whether we are doing enough given the hazards that we face.
Alter says from a building perspective, there can be concerns because wildfire codes cost developers more money. Plus, there's the question of how much taxpayers will have to pay. She thinks the cost of not putting these codes in place, though, could be even greater.
we know that the next major wildfire in Austin is not a question of if, but when. And we really need to be zeroing in and making sure that we're doing everything that we can.
Late last week, a majority of the Austin City Council greenlit plans for a development of about 20 homes in a part of the River Place neighborhood that's at a severe wildfire risk. A spokesperson for the developer says they do plan to build the homes with wildfire codes in mind. Still, no citywide codes are yet in place. That could change soon. Austin City Council members are expected to take up a proposal for wildfire codes at the end of the year. Reporting in Austin, I'm Jill Ament for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A Texas teen accused of killing 10 people last year at Santa Fe High School remains in custody, but after an evaluation by three psychiatric experts, all have agreed he is not competent to stand trial at this time. A judge is expected to sign off on the findings. But then what happens? To help us understand how a suspect's competency is restored, Austin defense attorney Keith Hampton. Keith, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Let's clear up a few things. You are not associated with this particular case, but you have represented clients who were declared incompetent. What are the standards for incompetency? Is that statutory?
Yes, it's statutory. It also has roots in constitutional law. The standard is a person is considered incompetent to stand trial if they lack sufficient present ability to consult with their lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding, or they lack a rational as well as factual understanding of the proceedings against them. So you have to be very severely mentally ill or have a profound intellectual disability to be considered incompetent to stand trial.
Well, that sounds quite severe indeed, but it's my understanding that a trial had been scheduled for February. What happens now to the accused Santa Fe High School shooter? Where does he go, and is it possible to restore competency?
Yes, it is possible for them to restore his competency. The first step is for him to be transported into one of the state hospitals. The most likely one would be Vernon, because the nature of his offense, he's going to be deemed a danger. So they will send him there first for yet another series of evaluations. And at that point, they will decide what kind of medication might restore him, and they will also go over court proceedings and how he may assist in his own defense, how he may assist his lawyers in his own defense.
I just want to play this out a bit. He has to then be re-examined, and he has to be declared, once the judge signs off on the incompetency, as we expect the judge to do, the judge has to then declare the suspect competent to stand trial, or is the suspect presumed competent after a certain period?
Well, you start out as everyone is presumed competent, and unless someone makes a suggestion of incompetency. When that happens, the judge is obligated to appoint experts. He's already done that. He's got three experts saying this person is incompetent. The minute he signs the order declaring him incompetent, that is when the defendant is prepared to be transported into the hospital system.
If the suspect is not ever found to be declared competent to stand trial, that would mean that the suspect would not be able to assist in his own defense, right? That would be what the court would
be saying.
Right.
And he can't be tried until he is restored. and the judge says he is restored.
Does that mean for, in such a case, does that mean that justice isn't served or it's indefinitely delayed and denied?
It is for everybody. He is confined in a state hospital. And literally, this can go on for years. To be incompetent is to be profoundly mentally ill.
What I think a lot of listeners may be a little confused about the distinction between being competent and the insanity defense, or plea, if you will. How would you describe the difference?
Yeah, big difference. Incompetency is simply a standard by which a person can be tried. Incompetency only concerns the person's ability to assist in his own defense at trial. Insanity is an affirmative defense about the person's mental state at the time they committed the alleged offense.
Keith Hampton is a criminal defense attorney based in Austin. He's handled a lot of these cases. Keith, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to explain things to us on the Texas Standard.
You bet.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this, what is it now, the fifth day of November?
I remember.
He's our social media editor here. What are you seeing on the social media platforms?
Well, we're hearing, unsurprisingly probably, about Austin's homelessness policies and its conflict with the state. Conversation about this topic seemingly everywhere. Even Fox and Friends, the national program, was covering it this morning, had an interview with Austin Mayor Steve Adler. So it's probably on the president's radar now since he is such a big Fox and Friends fan. Well, as we heard earlier, yes, on orders from Governor Greg Abbott, the state cleared out camps of people experiencing homelessness in Austin yesterday, and city officials also cleared camps outside of the city's at-capacity homeless shelter.
Right.
Lots of folks chiming in via Facebook. Boots McGee writes, "My heart goes out to the homeless population in Austin. There are so many factors that contribute to this this situation. Simple-minded victim blamers will keep doing what they do, but don't give up," she says to those people experiencing homelessness. "You are beautiful, valuable people." Meanwhile, Shanna Lee Afzal says, "It's so ridiculous that the state doesn't have a plan. Just removing the quote-unquote eyesores to satisfy the self-absorbed, the rich, and Governor Abbott. At least build another shelter or give them options since winter is coming." Lots of people continuing to follow this and really exploding into a sort of national story. You know, we've seen that also with the situation on the West Coast with San Francisco, the president sort of using policies there and the situation there in Los Angeles and San Francisco as a sort of punching bag. So it could be interesting to see if something similar happens here with the Texas Capital
City. Yeah, for sure. You know, if you didn't hear our conversation with Phyllis Snodgrass, who's the CEO of Austin Habitat for Humanity, go back and check it out over at texasstandard.org. What was stood out to me was how Phyllis said, "Look, you got to get community buy-in for whatever you do with these things." And that's one of the reasons why, for instance, Habitat is designing their new homes to sort of meet the community standards and needs and make them attractive. And, and you know, I totally understand what is at root here in this situation. I think we all do. And where do the homeless go once you clear out all these? But having community buy-in is so important to the political issue.
Yeah, I think of the situation here in Austin. I think one of the people that I believe the governor reached out to, a divisive figure, the governor in this situation, but he reached out to Alan Graham, who's part of this very popular group in Austin called Mobile Loaves and Fishes, who was doing some very creative things with housing the homeless population. So,
interesting guy.
Trying to bridge those divides.
Yeah.
Well, we're continuing to hear about Election Day. Robert Bob Flood, he says the Texas voters can't blame the situation they find themselves in if they are not part of the solution. So another reminder to get out there and vote. And you know, you and I were talking about the Texas Constitution earlier, David.
Right.
Our friend Rachel Osher Lindley, the glue that holds together the Texas newsroom, she informs us that Alabama has the longest state constitution, the most amended constitution
On, Texas. We got some catching up to do. That's been, I think, the only constitution amended more than the Alabama constitution, from what I read, is the California constitution, although it's not quite as big as Alabama's. Yes, wordy Alabamans, apparently. No. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over texasstandard.org, and we'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.
PRI, Public Radio International.